Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order. Today we're going to do a number of really, really interesting topics. Really interesting. So I don't want anyone to go to sleep. Anyone.
It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon after lunch. You're entitled, right? Okay, so we're going to take, we're going to have an informational hearing on Project Independence. Oh, here we go. Okay, Project Independence. Kathy Cooper. Elaine Young. Kathy Cooper. Okay. And
the late Senator Cruz.
I don't know what I'm doing.
I know. Tell me about it. Okay. Introduce yourself,
Senator
please.
Senator Morissette and members of the committee. I am Kathy Cooper. I'm the Deputy Assistant Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities within the Department of Human Services. And I have with me Elaine Young, who is the manager of our State Unit on Aging program and also responsible for the Oregon Project Independence program within the department. So this afternoon, we would like to just briefly give you an update on a budget note and a report that was required back to the legislature from our last Ways and Means presentation. We were required to submit our final report to the Assembly in January, and we have done that at this time. The important piece, we were before your committee in November, on November 18th, and we did give you an update on the progress we had done around the Oregon Project Independence budget note. And from that budget note, we were directed to be very inclusive with not only our AAAs, but a number of our community partners and also our consumers. And we're very, very happy to report that we did four focus groups on a statewide basis. We did a number of focus groups, almost 17 of them, in our local areas, statewide, in every part of our state. We did input on the website for people that wanted to make comments back to us. We did a consumer satisfaction survey to hear individuals who actually are receiving OPI services, Oregon Project Independence services, and then we compiled all of that information. We had over 700 respondents to this inquiry about the services of Oregon Project Independence. We have compiled all of those comments. There's 117 pages of comments, and we have put the website for your perusal at any time. If you'd like to see the statewide comments, or if you would like to see your own local area comments. But the important point is it generated a great deal of communication and comment, and we took all of those comments and we have put them in this report that we have before you. The report is the department's response to our budget note. We want to be very clear that we have submitted to you SPD recommendations from Seniors and People with Disabilities. The process from here is that we would go forward with, in the spring, we would be doing some rulemaking, and we would have a great deal of public and consumer comment as we move forward on adoption of rules and policies, which we hope that we would be able to have in place by July 1, so that the second year of the biennium we could implement some of these changes. So what we would like to do just very briefly is Elaine would like to take a few minutes. We would like to walk through our recommendations from this report, from all the input we have heard statewide, and then do a quick summary for you.
Okay. Now, what I have in mind is that you're here to answer questions, basically.
Perfect.
However, are you going to walk through it page by page?
No.
Okay, I have page by page marked for questions.
Perfect.
But go ahead and do the walkthrough, and then we'll come back and be specific. We will be specific in our questions.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, again, I'm Elaine Young, Program Manager for Seniors and People with Disabilities. As Kathy mentioned, we had a vast amount of input on the questions posed to our stakeholders, and they fell into basically four key areas the discussions were centered on. One was core services. What services within OPI should be assured to be offered statewide? The issue of statewide standardization, the issue of client cost sharing, and then the goals and the focus of the OPI program. What is set out in statute currently, is that still relevant and to the point? So I'm going to quickly go through those four key areas and share with you SPD's recommendations related to those areas. The first area of core services, based on the input that we received, we would recommend defining case management, home care services, and personal care services as the primary core services of Oregon Project Independence. Further, we would provide technical assistance to our field and look at our rules to assure that all the components of case management are met before they are those expenses are funded by OPI. That being that an assessment has been done with the client, a service plan developed, implementation of that service plan, and then ongoing follow-up to assure that the services are being met and are meeting the needs of the client. We would also look at our rule with respect to funding case management at Oregon Project Independence, that we only fund case management for clients who are receiving home care and personal care services, which isn't necessarily the case today. And then the last recommendation under core services would be one thing that we're recommending is how do you assure that those core services are the priority services of the program? One way to do that would be to adopt an administrative rule that it prioritizes those core services by allocation. Now, this is just an example and would have to be vetted through a public process, but one could, as an example, state that the AAA allocation for OPI, that a minimum of 50% must be spent on home care and personal care for clients, that no more than 30% be spent on case management, 10% on administration, which is the current rule, and then 10% on other services that could be funded through OPI. The second key area of discussion was around statewide standardization. And our recommendations related to that issue would be to implement a statewide fee collection policy. There's been some inconsistency across the state in terms of collecting the fees related to the sliding fee scale that are charged to clients based on their income. That we have a statewide policy related to wait lists so that no matter where you're at in the state, the criteria for getting off the wait list and onto services is consistent. Another recommendation would be to limit service hours to 25 hours per month for OPI. And the reason for this is OPI has always meant to be a preventative program, that little bit of services combined with family supports and community supports to assist somebody to stay in their own home, in their own home community, and not spend down to Medicaid. And so by limiting those hours, we are helping the AAAs administer the program with that preventative service in mind, and also to be assisting clients that need a lot more service than services than what OPI can possibly provide to them. So keeping that scope of OPI small and preventative in nature versus trying to be the end-all for everybody, or for all clients. And lastly, under statewide standardization, we see a need to adopt annual performance measures for the program so that we can adequately report back to you both what clients are saying in terms of their satisfaction of the program, but also the efficacy of the program in terms of, when, you know, are people, be, are we avoiding nursing facility placements? Are we avoiding spend down to Medicaid through this program? And then the next area of discussion that we have a set of recommendations on is client cost sharing. And we looked at, currently, as you know, there is not an income nor an asset test for the OPI program, although based on income, participants pay a cost of their home care services. So we would look at instituting an income test and an asset test for OPI eligibility. And we looked at Project 2020, which is on discussion right now in Congress, about what in terms what how do you identify somebody who's at risk for institutionalization? And in the work done on Project 2020, with respect to income and assets, it's been identified that people who are at 300% of SSI, which is approximately an income of $2,000 a month, and have liquid assets of approximately 6 months' stay in a nursing facility, which in Oregon would be $40,000. That identifies people that are at risk of spending down to Medicaid. So again, if OPI is looked at a program to prevent the spend down to Medicaid, then if we target the program to people who are most at risk of that spend down based on income and an asset test, then we would be targeting our services to exactly what the goals of the program are.
Okay.
So we would recommend.
Let me interrupt right here. What does it mean under cost sharing, under client cost sharing? The bullet point, introduce statutory language to change. A statutory language change to remove the requirement of annual fee.
Oh, yes. The statute currently has language that there be an annual fee assessed to all OPI clients regardless of their income, and that has been set at $5. What we are in recommending an income and an asset test in the first bullet that I was just describing, we would recommend removing that requirement for that $5 annual fee, which is administrative burdensome and really unnecessary if you're going to have an income and an asset test to OPI. So that's the purpose of that second bullet. And then the third bullet under cost sharing is pretty much overwhelmingly from the input that we received, people did not think that OPI should be that estate recovery should be a part of the OPI program for a number of reasons. One is that we don't want to push people to Medicaid, to the Medicaid program, because we know that the Medicaid program is going to be much more costly than OPI. Also, the amount of money we spend on OPI, if you compare the administrative burden of doing a state cost recovery to what the state's actually spending on the OPI program, you're going to spend more trying to recover those costs through an estate recovery process than you would compared to the outlay of dollars with respect to OPI.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What's it going to cost to do the asset assessment?
Well,
you're talking about eliminating administrative burden. You're talking about eliminating two, but you're adding one.
Our preliminary discussions, and again, would need to be vetted through a more public process, is that to not make it an asset test as we do with Medicaid, but make it a self-declaration and an attestation on the part of the client of what their assets are, rather than going through an onerous process of determining exactly what their assets are.
So it'd be self-reporting.
Self-reporting.
And when you and there, Mr. Chair, there's you're talking about individual with assets of approximately 40, but you said liquid, so that doesn't mean real property.
That would be correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There's a second in here that you're coming to under the 2020 project. Oregon could capture federal funds for OPI by matching percent of so on and so forth. So it sounds right now that Congress, how does that mesh with OPI not being a federal program? It sounds like we're going to move in that direction if Congress wants us to.
Senator Morissette, the efforts that Congress is looking at right now is from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and they too are very concerned about the cost of Medicare and Medicaid and what's happening on the federal budget level. And so they too are focusing on the preventive side of the services. So It appears what Congress is recommending is to take some of the dollars that are currently in the Medicaid side of the program and begin to use it as a preventive service to do some things around chronic disease management, around falls prevention, around some of the services Oregon has been doing under a pilot right now.
Now, the pilot is, I think, in Lane County.
Yes.
And we do have the single point of entry.
Yes.
We've had that, and that's exactly what they do. Go ahead.
On the Aging and Disability Resource Center side.
Yes, absolutely.
Correct. The second part of it is that Medicare is a very, very large portion of the funding that Congress has concern about. And what they did was they did look at the whole concern of spend down and looked at the overlay that it would cost to have a person that's on the Medicare program spend down into the Medicaid program in a nursing facility. So they actually are targeting, even in the budget write-up, some Medicare dollars and directing those to efforts around hospital discharge planning and around nursing facility diversion services to keep people really safe and in their own home. So Congress is sort of coming where Oregon has been for 20 years or more with Oregon Project Independence, recognizing really the real core value of having people stay in their homes and supporting them with very little dollars, but we support people for their lifespan without ever having to come into the Medicaid program. So it's a very positive step forward for
Oregon. We're talking about cost and the feds. Include case management. Let's see. Using federal dollars in place of Meals on Wheels, we would use the federal program for Meals on Wheels. I'm looking for that. Okay, we can come back to that. Okay, for a minute. Go ahead.
Did you want?
Yeah.
Just finishing up on the last area of discussion, and that was around goals and focus of the OPI program. And we would recommend, again, a review of the statutory language just to assure that it does emphasize the preventative nature of the program. And then we also recommend, currently the statute discusses opening up the program to younger people with living with disabilities if funds become available. And as we testified in November, that's been a multi-year wait for funds to become available. So the department would recommend going forward with opening the OPI program up to serve people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Using Older American Act funding for the Meals on Wheels program.
Right. Senator Morris.
And not use OPI money for other related programs, to just concentrate on, as you said earlier, the core programs. So is that feasible?
Senator Morissette, we actually took this report and then we did conference calls with all of our AAA directors and all of our stakeholders so we could get their comments back on our recommendations. This was one area of concern for both our AAA directors and for our consumers, that there is not enough money in the Older Americans Act funds that Oregon receives. We receive about $34 million a biennium of federal dollars, which pays for our congregate and our home-delivered meals. And what our AAA directors really tried to say is that's not enough even today to meet the needs of people, and that's why they've been using the Oregon Project Independent Funds. So it is something that we will look at as we go forward. Again, not knowing all of the details of what Congress might do and other funding sources, we would take all of that into consideration as we move forward on role changes.
Okay. 25 hours a month is difficult, and there are 17 different AAAs around the state with different capacities and so on. That's going to be interesting. And how are you going to implement performance measures? Will they be, you will develop the statewide performance measures and then see how the various AAAs measure up to them, is that right?
Yes.
And who will develop the performance measures?
Senator Morris said, members of the committee, we would do that in collaboration with our partners, the Area Agencies on Aging. And we have to look at our existing data systems also as we develop those performance measures, because obviously we can't develop measures that we don't have the capacity to actually get the data to determine how we're doing on those. So we would, in collaboration with the AAAs, we would look at our existing data systems and develop those performance measures so that, and particularly, again, around consumer satisfaction, and then what is the efficacy of the OPI program to the client in terms of not spending down to Medicaid and or not going into a nursing facility or some other licensed care facility. And I think our current data systems will enable us to answer those questions.
Okay, when I introduced Senate Bill 870 in 05, mm-hmm. it simply said that the people with disabilities would be included. That was what the bill originally said. And then, lo and behold, as the bill moved along, it was changed. And I know there was some pushback at the time from some seniors who said, we don't have enough money to deal with seniors. Why are we including other people in it? And my feeling was that disabled individuals should also have an opportunity. Now, when you have the breakdown of those who participate in Project Independence by age, there's a third, a third, and a third, but they're all over 60 years old. So to what extent are we serving people with disabilities who are not seniors?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, today we are still restricted by the current rule and the current policy because the last part of Senate Bill 870 indicated that the department could not move forward until we had enough funding available.
That was after we passed the bill on the Senate side, and I wasn't paying attention to it, I guess, when that was added. But, okay, so what are we going to do with that?
Senator Morissette, the recommendation that our department has made in this report is that we open Oregon Project Independence to seniors and people with physical disabilities 18 or older in July after we adopt rules. And then it would give us at least a year to see how many younger individuals with disabilities come forward for services. It also would help us describe what types of services people with disabilities need that might be different than seniors. And we think that that's a very important step for us to do since we have been waiting since 2005 to really implement what we believe is a fair part of the Oregon Project Independence.
Now, why are we serving Medicaid patients in disability levels 1 through 13 when we theoretically should be serving disability levels 14 through 17? Because if they're eligible for Medicaid, why aren't they on Medicaid? Why do we use Project Independence money to serve them?
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, to qualify for Medicaid, you need to qualify functionally, which means that you have dependencies in the survival priority level 1 through 13.
Yeah.
But you also must qualify financially, which means that you have assets of no greater than $2,000. So we do serve people under Oregon Project Independence that would qualify for Medicaid functionally, but they do not qualify for Medicaid financially.
We service them all the way to level 3, according to your... I mean, it just so happens that we have that level of dependence in the people that we do serve, and so I know it's kind of hard. And the frustration... Now, are we going... Okay, getting into the asset test, we have a statewide asset test, right, means test, that we... How carefully do we follow that?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, with respect to OPI?
Yeah.
Currently, there is no asset test or income test related to eligibility for Oregon Project Independence. Income does become a factor as to how much of the hourly home care worker rate the client would pay. It's on a sliding fee scale based on income.
That's what I was talking about. I'm sorry, I should have been more clear. We don't have it based on disability or anything like that, but it is based on their ability to pay. But I guess one of the criticisms that I've heard from a member of the legislature that actually worked with OPI people who didn't support OPI was because there were people gaming the system. So my question is, is this a standard procedure that is, how do we enforce that? How do we decide how much a person who can afford to pay will actually pay? Is it based on their income?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, currently Oregon Project Independence, how much they pay towards the cost of their in-home care services is based on their income. There is a sliding fee scale.
But is this carved in stone somewhere? Or is it just...
Oh, no, it is an adopted fee schedule that is published and is used by all of the area agencies on aging.
Okay, that's what I was just wanted to be sure. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. I'm always leery of state standards, one-size-fits-all sort of things, clearly because all 17 operate in different ways because they have different communities they're dealing with. And the other thing, I guess I'm kind of, you know, OPI does not prevent people from spending down or going into nursing homes. At best, it delays that from happening because eventually, you know, the acuity gets to the point where that happens. So when you said, I thought I heard you say prevent people from entering nursing homes. If you delay it by 5 years, you've done something very miraculous. So I'm just a little unclear as to, if you say prevent as a standard, you're probably not going to get there because regardless of what services we give people, they're going to get older and they're going to get more frail and their needs are going to increase. So I don't have a total comfort level with some of the stuff, at least on the front end at this point.
Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, it's been my experience, and again, I can't show you hard data, but when we have periodically looked at OPI clients and whether or not they go into nursing facilities, frankly, what we have found is that they have lived out their lives in their own homes with the assistance of OPI and indeed have not gone into long-term care facilities.
Yeah, well... And that's great that happens, but I guess the point is if that's the general case, but there are some who do matriculate further into the system, I don't want to see the program being called a failure because of that. Because, okay, I mean, that was my point. So.
There's one other question that... It's on the very last page, and it says, on average, the cost of Medicaid in-home care services is $1,273 per month. The general fund portion is approximately $509. And then it kind of skips over residential care, assisted living, which are between that and nursing homes, which is $6,500 per month. I thought James was going to be here, and I forget, and maybe you know, I forget how much the state pays for the nursing home care, the state's portion of nursing homes.
Senator Morissette, the $6,500 is the monthly amount that Medicaid pays
for
nursing facility.
State fund. Okay, I thought that $500 was Medicaid. I thought that was connected to the in-home care. The average cost of Medicaid nursing facility care is similar to kind of Okay. I thought we paid a lot more than that for nursing home care. Because that's why we want to keep people out of nursing homes. We want to put them in you know, when OPI started, there was only in-home care. We didn't have assisted living. We didn't have many assisted living or residential care, which are the intermediate steps. And nursing home is the most expensive, and we want to try to keep people out of nursing homes.
Senator Morissette, to respond to your question, if we look on at a scale, in this report we show that OPI monthly amount is approximately $200 to $250 a month.
Right, right.
Our in-home program is approximately $1,200 a month. Our services and community-based services is somewhere around $1,600 a month. And the cost of nursing facilities is $6,500 a month.
Yeah, and that's...
So that's exactly why we're trying to keep people out of nursing facilities.
How much of that does the state pay, and how much does the Medicaid pay on the $6,000?
Senator Morissette, today, because of the ARRA funds from the federal government,
yeah,
we're getting about a 70% payment from the federal government on that nursing facility cost.
Okay. So that's why I think for every 100 nursing home patients, we cost $10 million in a biennium, something like that. We had that figure out there at one point in when we were in 2007, I believe. It was during the last February session where we put $10 million into reimbursement to assisted living and residential care, was specifically to keep people out of the nursing home because we would have... So that's our big problem right now, as with the baby, the tsunami is washing over us from all the baby boomers who are getting ready to retire, and the economy is bad, and if people end up in a nursing home, we have to pay for a large part of that.
Senator Morissette, you're absolutely correct, and just to give you an update on where that $10 million was spent, we deployed staff across the state that are transition coordinators that are doing what we call diversion and transition from nursing facilities.
Yeah.
We have already transitioned or diverted over 2,400 individuals in Oregon and have saved, I believe the number is somewhere close to $14 million in this last year from the costs of nursing facilities. So we have actually taken to heart the message that we keep delivering here at the legislature. We have made a significant inroad in diverting people from nursing facilities.
Wonderful. Other questions? Nicole Palmateer, would you come up, please? Would you just wait right here, and we'll get Nicole up and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a curiosity question. Is any of this, and if so, how much has been facilitated by the Transformation Roadmap study?
Senator Morissette, Senator Telfer, actually the work that I just described on diversion and transition was very much a part of our transformation activity, and that's where we've been able to achieve all of those savings, and we've metrics those all out both for an annual savings and then as we go forward what those savings will be for the state.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
Thank you. The study was a three-year implementation period of time. So is the implementation done and now recognizing the cost savings, or are we still implementing?
Senator Morissette, Senator Telfer, SPD's portion of the transformation roadmap, if you will, we are about probably almost halfway through that roadmap doing what we call rapid process improvements and a number of other activities. We're in the process right now across all of our offices, both at our management and at our staff level, to do what is called daily management, using daily management skills, and we're training staff in doing that right now, and that is moving forward. We have done some significant other rapid process improvements that have both achieved savings, have achieved better responses for clients, more timely decisions, and we'd be glad to give you a report on our status at this time.
That would be great. I'd appreciate
glad to
that.
Do that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Nicole.
So
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Palmatier Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and we are the service providers of the Project Independence Program throughout the state. We received the report from the Department of Human Services late last week, so we're kind of in the process of understanding exactly what these recommendations mean, but we appreciated the efforts of the department to look statewide, to speak to clients, to speak to the case managers, to speak to stakeholders in the public to gain opinions. We agree that there is definitely a good opportunity to revisit some of the items in here, such as the wait list, eliminating the $5 annual fee. The age neutrality is something that we've been very passionate about, obviously, since 2005, and looking at the opportunity to be able to make the program age neutral and look at need and look at physical disability regardless of the age to see if somebody's able to be in Project Independence. There are some of the things in here that we have some questions on, and I know there'll be a further process by the department as they go forward to look and delve into these. The recommendation for case management, looking at service-only related case management, is something we'd like to talk about with case management. Sometimes, as you know, there are very limited funds with Project Independence. Sometimes we're able to only offer case management, but through that we're able to direct a potential client who can't receive services because there just aren't enough funds, but maybe we can connect them with some other services. Otherwise, there's nothing else we can do, but that is something that we're able to do in a lot of different areas. The limitation on service hours is something that we'd like to look at a little bit further and see what that means in practical terms for the clients that are currently receiving maybe that or a little bit more, potential clients, and how that impacts it, as well as if at some point we are able to add people with physical disabilities. That's a whole new service sector for this program, and we don't really know what that's going to look like and what that's going to mean. Will it be the same? Will the services be the same? Or will people have different needs? So that's something we would want to talk about. The limitations on allocations for funds for the different types of services within the program. One of the beauties of OPI has been the flexibility of it at the local level. As Senator Cruz pointed out, different places require different things. In the east side of the state, the transportation becomes a very significant expense because it takes a lot longer to get to a doctor. It takes a lot longer to get to the grocery store. It takes a lot longer for those things, and sometimes that might be more important than the in-home care. It varies by place to place, so we look forward to that conversation. The report talks about other funds that can be used for things like case management, nutrition programs, and as Kathy alluded to, there is some concern about that because older American dollars certainly were meant to be used for Meals on Wheels and those kinds of programs, but those funds haven't changed for a long, long time, and the need for that has shot through the roof. It certainly is something that we see continue to increase, and I would say in the last year we've seen a lot more people who are needing that kind of help. So sometimes we are able to offer assistance with meals rather than bringing somebody into the home to provide care because meals is what they need, and we're able to use a little bit of OPI dollars for that versus service care or something of that nature. And the other thing we want to look at is any increase in administrative burdens or administrative costs that might come from proposed changes. I think that's important to remember that one of the reasons OPI is able to provide benefit to the state is that it runs so efficiently. We're able to serve clients $200, $250 or so per month because our administrative cost is so low. By not being a Medicaid program, we're able to run very, very lean, and we try very hard to stretch those dollars as much as we can. In the beginning, Project Independence was a preventative program, an early intervention, a diversion program, but as services have been cut, it has become a safety net program. It has moved away from what the original intent was purely because we have cut people from services and they don't have anywhere else to go, and Project Independence was a way that we could help save some of those people when they weren't able to receive services otherwise. So some changes that have happened in the program have been as a result of just the way that the need changes in the state. But we look forward to the conversation. We look forward to some ways that we can make Project Independence a better program and continue to serve as many clients as we possibly can, because we only see the need growing exponentially. Thank you.
So what do you think of the performance measure proposal?
Senator Morissette, we are in favor of performance measures. We also are in favor of any way that helps us quantify the value of project independence and the value of investing upfront in these kinds of services. Some of the studies that have been done around Project 2020 have shown there can be a significant financial benefit to a state if you're willing to put the dollars in upfront rather than on the back end, and it would be nice to be able to track that here and see truly what project independence has been able to do.
Good.
Mr. Chair, I got no problem with performance measures improving the programs as long as the bureaucratic side doesn't get so onerous that folks are spending time writing out reports rather than serving clients.
I think that's a good
thing. I mean, there's a fine balance there.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. Oh, Senator Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I get a little disturbed that every budget cycle, Oregon Project Independence, that's dear to a lot of our hearts, comes up and with a lot of angst about what's going to happen with it. And I would really love for us to move away from that and just kind of accept Oregon Project Independence as a wonderful program, and we need to figure out how to do it better and so forth. So, having said that, I would wish that one of you would clarify something for me, because sometimes I have difficulty in taking the kind of jargon that we all use in the building and deciphering it and putting it into the real language outside of the building so that people can understand exactly what is happening. And we talk about the baby boomers, and there are a couple of things here. What age groups are you identifying when you're talking about Oregon Project Independence outside of those, irregardless of age or disabled? But those who are part of Oregon Project Independence, and what age group are you considering when you talk about the baby boomers and the increase in ages? Because are you talking about 20 years out? I just need clarification to know what you're saying so that you, if I'm saying something, that we are both saying the same thing.
Senator Morissette, Senator Berger, thank you for your comments. First of all, I just want to highlight we too see Oregon Project Independence, or really the services of in-home services, as a critical component as we discuss some of the national efforts, the activities going on in Lane County around aging and disability resource centers. It really is focusing on prevention, on in-home services, and Oregon Project Independence is central to us being successful in the prevention for about the 97% of Oregonians that are not served today through the Medicaid program. To specifically answer your question, today in Oregon Project Independence, it's individuals 60 years or older that are served, and they're served up until death. It can be any age at the top end, and we do serve people any age at the top end. Using the recommendations that were in Senate Bill 870 that Senator Morissette put forth, it would be individuals 18 or older that are people with physical disabilities, and then anyone 60 or older in the aging population.
Follow-up, please. Would you address the baby boomer age and the use of that term and the 20 years, or what period of time are you talking about?
Senator Morissette, Senator Berger, when we look at baby boomers, I believe the youngest or oldest baby boomer has just turned 60, now 62 at this time. So the boomer generation is now coming into what we now know as Oregon Project Independence. So it is this group that are entering into the services now out for the next 20 years or more.
Okay. So, all right. Thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Good. Other questions?
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
And we'll probably hear from you again before the next session in 11. We'll have interim health meetings, and we will be talking with you about progress that you're making and whether or not you need a bill to change some of the language and so on and so forth. I really like the idea of, I guess, the performance measures, if they don't become too burdensome, to show that Project Independence is working and give the local jurisdictions an opportunity to talk about what they do best. There has to be some flexibility because the 17 different agencies vary significantly. So, anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Morrison. Thank you, Senator.
Some of us baby boomers are going to refuse to boom.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to change the order very briefly, and we're going to do an update on affordable housing for seniors. Peter Ferris, would you come up, please? Now, later we do have a bill that is a committee bill that we will hear in relation to housing developments. That doesn't necessarily tie in with this, but that's an area of concern. So go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Good morning. Good morning. I'll tell you where I am. Good afternoon. My name is Peter Ferris. I am the executive director and lobbyist for the Oregon Manufactured Homeowners United. I live in a manufactured home park in Walport, Bayview, and I'm here today to talk to you about some of the impacts that this last decade had on affordable housing for seniors. I guess I could start off by saying that the decade of this first decade was a disaster for manufactured home parks in general for two reasons. One was that we had approximately 70 closures, and as Senator Telfer really knows, and Ben was one of those, and so it's been that was a kind of remarkable and yet very disastrous situation that took place, and most people ended up leaving their homes with really nothing. And in 2007, we did manage to deal with that in some ways, but we still have that problem, and we will still have that problem come if the economy returns. The other problem now is higher rents. We are the only organization that is tracking higher rents, and we do that through our website. And this is particularly happening in the South, as probably Senator Cruz knows. But it's happened because, in general, in the South, rents were affordable. And in the last 5 years, we have the five top parks in the state where rents have gone up over 50% in some of them. And the CPI at this time has been around 12.2% or 11.2%. So the situation is dire, and I don't have a lot of hope that it's going to change unless we can bring some regulation to these businesses and this industry. And I say that after 5 years of learning the statutes, learning how to lobby, learning, and actually I am drafting right now a bill, which is a rent justification bill for 2011. But this is dire, and I want to just talk to you briefly about one signature park that was closed in Wilsonville called Thunderbird Club. They had 280 units. It was a senior park. It was closed officially in the spring of 2008. Of the 280 spaces, approximately 11 people were able to move their homes to another site. So we have the demographics listed on our website. Most of the people there, of course, were widows, single women, who had lived in that community 20, 30 years, something like that, who identified with that community. And it was a real tragedy. I would say the rest of the homes were sent to the dump or sold for nickels on the dollar to two people. There was one Montana guy who was buying them up for like $2,000-$3,000 and transporting them all the way to Montana. And that became, that park became a kind of signature for what was happening. But now with the downturn of the economy, what we have is, unlike in rental units, where rental units are actually, the rates for rent are going down, the rents in our communities are going up, continuing to go up. And this is the result of a consolidation that took place in the 1990s and further consolidation this decade, out-of-state corporations buying in their absent landlords. They let their managers, who are usually poorly paid, take care of things. They do as little as possible in terms of maintenance. And so what we have happening in the parks, especially the senior parks, is a increasing anxiety about what to do about this, especially those who are on limited incomes. And two-thirds of our population are on limited incomes, just, you know, statewide. So we have this desperate kind of feeling about, you know, your home is no longer your castle. Your home is your prison. And what's been happening more recently is that when widows, especially single men too, when they are not able to afford the rents anymore, they literally have to leave the park. They have to deed their home over to the park owner, because the park owner will insist that that home, that they pay that rent on that home until they remove it. So they deed them over for free. The park owner then rehabs them and rents them out or sells them. And so when you think that this is their major asset, you begin to understand that these people, and on top of that, they lose their community. They have to either have to go and live with family or end up in a nursing home. And this is the one thing we keep on finding out, that because they have this sense of independent living, they are really reluctant to leave their homes, and yet they're having to do this. So we need some regulation about this, and I explain this in very simple terms, because what we have in the parks is a closed system. We have a system in which we are at checkmate from the beginning. We have no, there is no free market in these parks. And so what happens is that as the rents go up, your home continues to be devalued. And so this is a big problem, and we need to regulate these rents, in which is not to say that we don't want that. I mean, I'm drafting a bill right now, and I want to be very sure that we are able to supply, I mean, to give a fair rate of return. That's going to be a major part of this bill, fair rate of return. It's important. We have a lot of studies, and we have in California 106 ordinances in the state of California where there is rent control. And these ordinances have been around for 25 to 30 years. There's a lot of experience legislatively and legally speaking about these ordinances. And I am, in fact, been crafting an ordinance that's out of Healdsburg, California, that basically is very similar to the bill that we are drafting. So I think this is doable, but it will take your good sense and your good allegiance to public policy here to make this happen. Because This has been the way it's been for 34 years. 34 years ago, the state, in its great wisdom, separated those rentals, those apartment rentals, from manufactured home parks. The idea was, at least it's my understanding, is that these were two uniquely different animals, and they are. So this is the problem with, and this is not only a problem here in Oregon. Obviously, it's a problem throughout the United States, where we have 10 million people living in these parks, and the same thing is happening. The corporate mentality is such that, you know, their bottom line is their investors. I understand that, but at the same time, they are shooting themselves in the foot very often by raising the rent so high that now what we're seeing is rentals in the park. We're seeing vacant homes in the park. We have one park in Beaverton that has 75 vacancies. It's a large park. And it doesn't make any sense to me to do that, but that's what they're doing. That's what their strategy is. It has nothing to do with giving service. So we have this incredible resource. We have the largest source in this state of unsubsidized, affordable housing, and we're letting it go down the drain. And all it would take is regulation. And I know that park owners, when they see me coming, think that this is that I am sent from hell. But I'll tell you that I have their interest at heart too, because in order for this to work, I've got to convince them. I haven't done it yet, but I think that it's important to realize that this source of affordable housing will not exist in the future if we're going the way that we are today.
Okay. Now, we talked earlier about what I'm trying to do in Springfield is have dedicated park land that it can only be mobile home parks. Now, you mentioned that there are some places that take existing park property and dedicate it to exclusive use. I hadn't thought of that. What I'd like you to do is come back once you have your bill drafted and so on, and we can talk some more about it. But I think this is it's an important issue that we need to deal with. Are there any questions?
A couple questions.
Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
You know, as we talk about this, all this pain comes up from spending so much time with the City of Bend ordinance on this. So I know this topic, but a couple points of clarification. Rents. When you're talking rents, we're talking land rents or?
Space rents.
Space rents, not the unit rents, okay? And fair rate of return, we're talking about return fair to whom? The landowner or
the land? To the landowner.
Okay.
Yes.
And lastly, it sounds like this is a political campaign here, so I'm hoping that we're going to hear the other side of this.
I'm certain.
Because that's what I'm hearing today. You know, I'm hearing the... Been here, done this.
In fact, we are having a lobbying day on the 3rd of February, and we're inviting all of you to come and just to hear, you know, and to listen and to speak if you'd like. But I would say there's one other thing I would like to say, too, about what's happening in the parks is that when someone steps out and goes against the grain in the park, one of the things we're finding is a lot of bullying by managers, a lot of, we have political harassment happening, we have political harassment happening from other people, other tenants in the park saying, let's keep it cool, we don't want to antagonize the owner. So you have a very you have a community that's really actually being torn apart by these issues. And I think it's something that we really have to pay attention to.
Okay. We're going to have to move on here. Are there other questions, comments?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. Okay. Jeff Hetherington, presentation on recruitment and retention of primary care providers in Oregon. And then after the next presentation will be, Jeff, are you? ready to go. And then we're going to have an update on the Rural Medical Professional Liability Reinsurance Program, and these two are kind of tied together because if the program goes away, I'm afraid we're going to have some real problems, and there's no assurance that we have money to continue the program. And so there are two very interesting topics. One of them is how do we encourage more primary care physicians in rural areas or just in general? I guess that's what you're dealing with. So go for it.
Yes. For the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care Health Plans, which is a Medicaid, Medicare carrier in this state and has been for the last 25 years. I want to talk about the primary care system in particular because it's a great concern to not only me as an individual who just turned that age where they throw you out of their practices, 42, but also as an insurer, because that's one of the ways that, you know, we keep our health care costs down is relying on the primary care system. And I think the best way that I can characterize the primary care system, not only here in Oregon, but from what I hear from people all over the country, is using a medical term, and it's called failure to thrive. And the system has been failing to thrive for at least 30 years. It has been slowly going downhill, and we are now to the point where I think it's getting close to tipping. You've got a number of problems. First of all, we have a very low number of primary care providers, both family physicians and pediatricians, general internists at this point, and you have a low number of nurse practitioners. Neither one of those groups has a large supply chain. It starts at the admissions process. It goes through the medical school, the nursing schools. For the physicians, it gets into the residency programs. There are limited residency programs for the primary care area. For those that decide to go into primary care, they come out with huge debts that are pretty much lifelong debts because of revenue that you can expect as a primary care practitioner. And the problem, you know, at that point, that when we get into practice with the primary care practitioners, the problem is that they are now becoming what I would call supply chain type operations. Now, the doctors don't like it. They don't like practicing that way, but they're having to cut the time that they can spend with a patient in order to keep their practices open. So what used to be a 20-minute visit may be now a 15-minute visit, may now be a 10-minute visit. And it's because of the reimbursement practices that we have in this country, which reward procedure over the actual office visit. And that's sort of, in a nutshell, you know, where we are economically with primary care. We load them up with debt. We don't pay the primary care providers enough when they go into practice, and we wonder why we have a shortage. Now, it's pretty clear why we have a shortage. It's because we don't put the money into it. Where we do put the money in the healthcare system is into specialists who do the high-cost procedures. We put it into hospitals. We put it into pharmaceutical companies. We put it into DME. And the interesting thing to me is, and I'll make this point really clear, every time we talk about raising revenue and raising payments to primary care, someone says, I want to see the proof that this will save money. And even with the medical home discussions that are going on with the Oregon Health Authority on the medical home model, they say, well, we want to see the proof before we put the money into the system. And what I would like you to really hear is that primary care is the only part of the healthcare industry that has to prove anything before they get more money. We automatically raise payments to the hospital system every year through Medicare, Medicaid, and through the commercial insurance. They don't have to prove anything to get additional increases in their payments. The pharmaceutical industry just announced that they were going to up their charges by 9.5% for 2010. They didn't have to prove anything in order to do that, and we all, insurance companies, the governments, will pay those things. But when it comes to primary care, and I'll use Oregon as the example, we have left them at the same payment rate for the last 10 years. But if they want any more, they have to prove that they are worth it. Now, we need to change that. We need to change the whole system. And I know the physician here will talk about, you know, where the proof is. The proof is there for primary care providers. And I think we need to pay attention to that. The one other thing I'd like to say is it deals with where we can deal with this legislatively. So speaking to you all is what the legislature can do. And I realize that there's all the money in the world out there right now. But number one is to reduce the debt for those people who are going into primary care fields. And again, we were asked to talk about physicians, but I would say that includes the nurse practitioners also, because you need to reduce the debt because it's just way too high. The average physician comes out at $175,000 in debt. Think about how long it'll take you to pay that off at 12 to 18% interest, which is about what they're getting charged now. The second thing we need to do is we need to look at how the Medicaid system, PEB, and OEB reimburse primary care. It's under a very complicated system that uses a conversion factor times a formula, and I won't try and do that unless somebody really asks. And I know you won't. But the bottom line is that people who do procedures, surgical procedures, outpatient procedures, they get paid more per minute than the primary care physician gets paid per minute for seeing the patient. And the best example that I have heard is used by a family doctor that's in our program. He says, I can spend 20 minutes doing a circumcision from start to finish. I will get paid somewhere between $300 and $400 for that. If I spend 20 minutes with a patient, I'll get paid $80 to $90 on an office visit. And the question is which is worth more? You know, what we really need to do is to focus on giving the primary care physicians time with their patients. And the only way you can do that is to pay them more money. I would suggest that you look at an off-balance rather than an across-the-board RVU system that basically pays for primary care services at a higher conversion level for Medicaid, for your PEB system, and for your OEB system. And to show the commercial insurers, who have not been very good at understanding this problem either, that when you pay primary care better, you get more access, you get more primary care providers into your system, and you lower your costs. One of the things we did in the Medicaid program is we took a real hit in 2006 on the premium. DHS lowered the premium to the plans by 10% under the assumption that health care costs went down. I don't know where they got that, but that's another story. What we all did in order to mitigate the losses was we started increasing the payments to our primary care physicians more than we had. And that was to make sure that we kept the people at the best level of care. 90% of your care can be done at the primary care level if the primary care physician or nurse practitioner is paid for their services. If not, guess what? Access goes down to primary care. They end up in the emergency room. They end up delaying cost, which puts them either into the emergency room or into the hospitals or into a specialty care situation. And so I would say from all of the health plans under the Oregon Health Plan, we know the value of primary care. We pay for it. We pay for it different than we pay for specialty care, and we've kept the cost down. But we're about the only ones right now in Oregon that are doing so. And we're looking, you know, for ways to build that system and that model up, because by and large we can't compete now in terms of putting our patients, you know, into primary care systems.
Any questions? We're going to let Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Oh.
I don't know just exactly what happened in my district, but if I were listening to your presentation 2 years ago, I would have to agree with so much of what you said about the shortage of doctors, et cetera.
So you don't have to tell me.
In Reedsport, Oregon, which is on the coast, my district goes from Coos Bay to Lincoln City. Dr. Law was the only doctor there. Today, we have doctors advertising on the radio because there are too many doctors, or they've got enough doctors now that they need patients. Bay Clinic wouldn't take, the doctors there would take no new patients. Now there is a sign out on Thompson Road that says, taking new patients. About once a month, we have an ad in the newspaper introducing a new physician in the Bay Area. So what happened? Is my district totally different than the rest of the state?
I think you have two things that are going on. One would be less than the other. And the lesser would be that you do have physicians replacing older physicians who are retiring. That would be a small thing. The other thing is that in some communities, and some is a minority, you have the hospitals actually helping to underwrite recruitment and loan repayments for physicians, and that does help in terms of retention. If the long-term payment, you know, keeping their practice open is not enough, then they'll go away. But most of the time where you see an influx of physicians, you'll see usually a hospital helping to subsidize the recruitment of those physicians. And not all of them, frankly, are primary care.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I need to add that we also have specialists that
right.
we have not had before. We have a large hospital, and so I don't know if that is the case, but we now have specialists. For instance, there was one dermatologist there for years. Now there are about three. So something has happened in the last 2 years.
It's a beautiful place to live.
Oh, wow.
I don't stand that. Elizabeth, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Are you going to support what he says? Are you going to challenge him? Are you going to
support and add on to, if I may?
Oh, support and add on to. Very good. Okay.
Yes, sir.
More than a ditto.
No, a ditto isn't very useful. I wouldn't waste your time with just a ditto, Senator. Thank you, Senator Morissette, and members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, for inviting me to testify today. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Steiner. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, a single specialty society in Oregon that represents about 1,000 active physicians in Oregon. And really, more importantly, we represent our patients, your constituents. I'm here because, like Jeff Hetherington, I want to emphasize the importance of primary care to do a bunch of things in Oregon that we all care about. And we do have the evidence. We can show it to you. And if you want it, I'll give you articles till you don't have insomnia anymore. This evidence clearly demonstrates that the availability of primary care physicians in a community is directly related to the health of that community, the decreases in mortality in that community, and reducing health care costs. More family physicians and primary care physicians, the better you do on all three of those things. Let's talk about costs first. We know I apologize. We know that the supply of family physicians is associated with lower health care costs for services. There have been studies that have shown that if you look at the proportion, you know, one primary care physician per X thousand people, the better that ratio is, down to about one per 3,000, the better you do at reducing health care costs by reducing adverse events, just as Jeff was saying. For example, it's much better to see somebody for high blood pressure than to see them for a heart attack. Right? Oh, Sandy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And so we reduce those kinds of events, and we reduce hospitalizations, which are expensive. The other interesting thing is that there's really good evidence that shows that both internationally and across the United States, areas that have higher ratios of primary care physicians to the population, they have better health outcomes and longer lifespans. So not only do people live longer, they're healthier while they're doing it. They're not spending the last 2 years or 3 years of their life in and out of the hospital all the time. They're spending the last 2 years of their lives at home with their families, enjoying themselves. We know that they die less from heart disease, from cancer or stroke. We know there are better infant mortality rates or low birth weight. And this is true regardless of any other socioeconomic factors. Anything. Doesn't matter about the racial and ethnic mix of the community. Doesn't matter about the social status of the community. Doesn't matter about education. What matters is, do you have primary care providers on the ground in that community? That's what matters. The other point is, coming around again to this question of healthcare disparities, we also know that more primary care helps reduce healthcare disparities. It's a real concern in many of our communities where people of color, people of lower socioeconomic status, tend to historically have delays in diagnosis of cancer and therefore diagnosed at a later stage and have poor outcomes. They tend to have don't show up for their high blood pressure until they've had a heart attack or a stroke, et cetera, et cetera. And we know that, again, having a physician right there in their community, a primary care physician, reduces the risk of all of those things happening, those late diagnoses of manageable problems. Here's the other piece of this that I think you're really going to like. We talked before about lowering costs. The other really good piece of this is having a primary care physician in your community generates an enormous amount of income in that community, an enormous amount of economic revenue. A recent study by the Robert Graham Center for Policy Studies looked specifically at Oregon and said, for every family physician in your community, there's a positive economic impact of over $853,000 per year. That's a non-trivial sum of money in my book. And that's simply by getting a family physician into the community, generating jobs, improving productivity by keeping people on the job instead of out sick, all sorts of things like that, in the sales in the community. So we think that that's great. And that doesn't even include things like other local healthcare organizations or hospitals. So, given all this, it really is clear that bringing more primary care physicians into practice in Oregon would have multiple advantages today for our state. And we know, if you look at all the data from both national and international studies, that the best ratio is probably about 50% true primary care physicians to, of all the doctors, 50% of them should be primary care physicians. And in fact, if we could get Oregon to that place 10 years from now, we would be saving the lives of 4 Oregonians a day. Now, we talked last term, some of you may have heard us talking about our little hazelnut thing. We were talking about losing the life of 1 Oregonian every day just because they didn't have insurance. This is even better. If we bring in enough family physicians that we have 50% of our docs as primary care, we will save the lives of 4 Oregonians, over 1,200 Oregonians a year. That's a significant number as well, especially when people die young. So, what's the challenge? Jeff talked about a lot of this, debt. I got a slightly less worse number than Jeff, but $155,000 is still a lot of debt to come out with. And as Jeff said, primary care physicians are reimbursed less. I'm not going to talk about reimbursement. It's not really important to us. What's important to us is being able to keep a roof over our heads, buy a house without already paying basically a mortgage in debt. And I will say that the only place that we do notice this is Medicare reimbursement, whereas I think you all know, we are one of the lowest reimbursed states for Medicare in the nation, and it's one of those catch-22s. We get paid less because we provide better care, so our health care costs are less. So instead of rewarding us the way Jess Group is doing and saying, look, we know that you guys are the people who are keeping the health care costs down, we get punished. It doesn't cost as much to get care in your state. You don't need to be paid as much. Go figure. So what do we do to make this difference? We've got a whole bunch of ideas, many of which we've talked with you about before. We're going to continue to talk with you about. Loan repayment is really, really important for primary care. And we have had this in the past. Unfortunately, that got taken out last session. We understand we've done this with a tax credit that we've had in this state. Other states have also had very successful methods, including specific allocations for family medicine from the legislature to the medical school. So not giving the medical school just one lump sum of money, but giving some of that money specifically designated for family medicine to improve our ability to train medical students in that specialty to get them out into true primary care. And also with assistance from the state in setting up more family medicine, general internal medicine, and general pediatrics training programs to really provide true primary care physicians to go out and serve our communities. The Oregon Academy of Family Physicians has been invited by the House Healthcare Committee to submit a package of primary care legislation prepared in collaboration with other relevant partners to the 2011 legislative session. And we're developing our key points for this proposed legislation, and we'll be starting work with our partners in March after this year's legislative session. We anticipate including a wide range of ideas to address effectively the state's need for better health care at lower costs. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? So part of the plan has to do with our payments to medical education based on number of primary care to tie that somehow together. So there is an incentive for them to concentrate on more primary care.
Yes, so that's one of a range of things that we think would be helpful. We think this has to be a multi-layered approach.
Okay.
Well, I was going to say that needs to occur not only at the medical school level, but actually at the residency level also, because what we do in Oregon, we fund graduate medical education through our Medicare program, or Medicaid program, and it's a lump sum. We had a bill in during the last session to focus all of that money onto primary care, and was not received too well by certain institutions, but if you're gonna build up primary care, because there's not enough to recruit from outside, you have to do it literally from inside the system. You're going to have to focus money on primary care training.
Okay. Hey, just if I may, Senator Morissette, to add on an interesting piece of information to that, there is very clear evidence that shows that somewhere between 50 and 70% of physicians go into practice within a 50-mile radius of where they train. Okay, so starting residency programs in our state is a proven way of increasing the supply of physicians for our state. If we start more family medicine residencies, we will be giving this state more family physicians who will stay here to practice. I'm one of them.
Yeah.
I'm a migrant.
One of the conferences that I went to in CSL had some testimony about that. And there are some states that have several medical schools in their state. They have one of them, I forget which one it was, had three of them, and two of them were in the semi-rural area, which I thought would be kind of neat to be able to then recruit and go to school there and stay there. People are trained in Portland.
Well, actually, at this point, Senator Morissette, we actually have a new program at OHSU that one of my colleagues, Dr. Lisa Dodson, helped start. She's now head of the AHEC, the Area Health Education Centers, and there's now something called the Rural Scholars Program, where students join that track starting in their third year of medical school, and they get an opportunity to do a lot more of their training out in rural parts of our state. I just ran into one of our third-year students who I've been working with off and on because she's interested in this policy side of medicine as well. for the past couple of years, and she's spending 3 months, a little bit longer than that, actually, out in John Day, doing three different rotations out there and really, really enjoying it and really valuing it. And we've got a bunch of medical students now who are interested in focusing on getting more of their training in rural areas, and we do hope that will help. But we're going to need them in the urban areas as well.
Yeah, I would make a comment. You talked about more than one school. We are, there is actually a new medical school being developed in Lebanon, and we'll start taking in students. But, you know, one of the other things to consider is there's a long road between entering medical school and starting practice. It's a 7-year process. So anything you did today would start to show fruit in 2018 or 19. And my only point there is let's get started.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson and then Senator Winters.
We had a lot of this discussion when we were doing health care reform and with the in 2009 in with our medical home model, and we talked about the need for more primary care physicians. And I am very curious when at some point in time we're going to need to have a report from the health authority saying how are they addressing this issue. And if you served on a subcommittee, it would be not, you could let us know where that's going.
Senator Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, thank you for asking that question. The health authority has established its task force on the medical home, and in fact, 3 or 4 members of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, including our current president, Dr. Glenn Rodriguez, and in fact, Senator Verger, Dr. Robbie Law, are on that task force, specifically because we have such a strong interest. That task force has just started its work, and I'm sure that we're all going to be waiting eagerly to hear more about it, but I trust that they will do some good work, and I trust the people that we nominated for that committee who ended up on it will be able to provide some important input about ways to structure these so that we'll be flexible enough to meet the needs of lots of different kinds of medical homes, but will also provide the benefit to the communities, the bang for the buck, if you will, that we know medical homes can provide.
Thank you. Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, because you mentioned not only the debt load issue, but also the capacity increase of primary care docs. But you also mentioned the issue of Medicare reimbursement, which is an issue that this body doesn't have a lot to deal with, yet it's one of the bigger issues that are out there. What work is being done with our own delegation to try to change that rate structure?
Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, we actually been working very closely with Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley, along with all of our representatives in the House, the Federal House, and discussing this. One of the things that has been in again, out again, in again, out again in the federal health reform legislation is a repeal of what's called the sustained growth rate version, which has actually been cutting payments to Medicare. And to be honest, you know, if this is Tuesday, it may be in again, and if this is Wednesday, it might come back out again. And I don't mean to sound flippant, but I think we all agree that this is in conference committee now, and who the heck knows what kind of an elephant is going to come out of it.
Or donkey,
yes, sir. I meant it in that way. I sort of meant that an elephant is like a horse designed by committee, you know, in that way. It's a sort of a funny-looking animal. I wasn't even thinking about the political ramifications. I apologize. wrong analogy. So you're right. We have no specific influence on that here, except that you all have relationships with our federal delegation as well, and you all can go back to them and say, your constituents, my constituents are hurting because of this, because we can't attract the kinds of doctors we need to increase the health in our communities. And so that's what we're doing. We meet with Senator Wyden, not quite every time he's in town, but pretty close. We're fortunate to have a good working relationship with him and Senator Merkley almost as frequently.
Well, what I might suggest to one of them is why don't you hold out and be the withhold a 60 of the vote until Oregon gets a fair deal.
Actually, both of them have been doing that quite well.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a long-running issue for Oregon.
It is.
This is not an issue that is new. And, you know, I would concur with your comments of a holdout. I mean, we're looking at 30 cents on a dollar, and in Florida and some of the other states are enjoying a better rate. The question becomes, you know, why are we penalized for doing good? And you had raised that, so I would encourage to continue working with our delegation.
Well, what I was suggesting is what a senator from Louisiana and a senator
and
from
Nebraska
did. Yeah, and they said, hey, everybody can't do that. But it is frustrating to know that they're actually talking about cutting the rates when there's a huge inequity exists, and we are being penalized because we're doing a good job. Originally, we were doing a good job, and we're being penalized for it. So
I don't know, Senator. Harry Reid said that every senator should have his own piece of pork in the bill. So,
well, that pork is what comes back to the states, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
Anyway.
And, well, Mr. Chair, just one other thing. I think that I know we're putting a lot of emphasis on physicians, but we have to remember that we have nurse practitioners, we have naturopathic physicians, and all of those will have to be a part of the solution to this problem, because 50% of, I think just about 50% now of the physicians or the new physicians coming out are women, and they have made the decision, many of them, to not work full time. So there's a whole lot of complexity here, and we have to be very creative in how we are addressing this issue.
Yeah. Senator Morrison, I'm sorry.
I would like to make one comment, because I don't disagree with your comments, Senator Mona Sanderson, but I would hate to see, and I have seen this in the legislature in my 30 years of lobbying here, that conversations about the nurse practitioners in particular and naturopaths tends to be used as a weapon for not doing things in terms of upping the number of family physicians. And I would just hope that we not do that. We don't have enough nurse practitioners either. You know, so let's not attack each other's house. Let's look at the whole thing and say, yes, we can increase here, here, and here. And so it's just a caution, because too many times I've seen that battle start, and frankly, it's the physicians who've lost every single time.
If I may, Senator Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, I think you bring up a really important point, and we don't disagree with you either. I spoke specifically about physicians because that's what we have the data on, and we unfortunately don't have as clear data on the impact of physician assistants, nurse practitioners. I actually include naturopathic physicians in my, when I say physicians, I mean that rather broadly, because I do think that they play an important role in this, but again, we don't have as hard data on that, that group of providers. There is no question in my mind that one of the things that the Medical Home Task Force will be looking at is how do we create a team environment in every office that means that every single person in that office, regardless of his or her position, is working up to the level of his or her license. And when we do that, that means that the nurse practitioners are seeing the most appropriate, most complex patients that they can see. The physicians are seeing the most appropriate, most complex patients, and they're working together as a team to provide high-quality health care for a group of patients who otherwise would be less well-served. So I agree with you. I just think I was only speaking about one group because I had hard data that I could be that I could rely upon. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to have to move along, and so we appreciate
thank you very much
being here, and thank you. And now we will get to the fun part of our agenda.
I thought we were.
Oh, yeah, this was the fun part. Okay. We'll get to the anticlimactic fun part. We're going to be talking about professional, let's see, update rural medical professional liability reinsurance programs. Corey Streisinger and Scott, would you come up, please, and give us some good news? No, just break it to us gently. How's that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and as you said, I'm here to give you an update on the program to support the payment of professional liability insurance costs for rural physicians. And as you mentioned, this is actually a very nice tie to the prior presentation because one of the goals of this program initially was to support primary care and the availability of primary care, particularly in rural areas. And as a number of you probably recall, this program was initiated in 2003. It was House Bill 3630 at the time. The goal was to assist in attracting and retaining physicians in rural Oregon with a particular emphasis on obstetrical care. And there was escalating concern at the time about the challenges of retaining and attracting those physicians and also about the escalating costs of medical malpractice insurance, which in the early part of the last decade was increasing pretty substantially. And, Senator, there is some good news at the end of this presentation in that regard, I will say. And the program was successful in providing premium assistance. And in 2007, it was initially a four-year program. So in 2007, the legislature took another look at it and continued it for another 4 years, but with some modifications. One of them was in recognition of the role of nurse practitioners. In 2007, you probably recall, we expanded the program to cover nurse practitioners in rural areas. And in addition, there was a minor modification to what areas are considered rural. There was concern about a particular area that seemed to be quite urbanized, and the definition was changed to exclude that particular area, which was Ashland, except with respect to doctors and nurse practitioners providing obstetric care. So the obstetrical care delivery in Ashland is still in the program. In addition, the other change that was made in 2007 was to provide that doctors and nurse practitioners, in order to participate in this program, had to be willing to serve Medicare and Medicaid patients. That is, they had to have a practice that was not closed to Medicare and Medicaid patients. Whether or not they actually had a Medicare and Medicaid caseload would be determined by their individual circumstances. The program continues to prioritize obstetric care, and those who practice obstetrics continue to receive the highest subsidies. 80% of the medical malpractice insurance premium for obstetricians and nurse practitioners certified for obstetric care, 60% for family practitioners or general practitioners whose practice includes obstetrics. There was another modification in 2007 regarding the other category, which initially everyone not in those first two categories received a subsidy at the 40% level. A distinction was made in 2007 to distinguish certain primary care areas from other specialties. And so those in specified primary care fields, pediatrics and family practice, continue to receive the subsidy at the 40% level, but subsidies for those in other specialties, and I think things like dermatology were mentioned,
plastic surgery,
receive a declining percentage, which was not more than 35% in 2008, goes down to 25% in 2009, 15% in 2010 and 2011, and subject to the availability of
funds. Okay, that's the famous glide path.
Correct.
Out.
Correct.
For some of these.
Yes.
So.
And so that's the program as it is in place today. I've attached to the testimony a summary of the expenditures from the program by year. There's also a chart showing you the number of participants in the program by year and also a breakdown by county and category. And I should note that some of the numbers, the expenditure numbers and the county breakdown, are through September 2009. The total number of practitioners is for the entire calendar year 2009. And during 2009, we had 827 doctors and 54 nurse practitioners participating in the program, total of 881 participants. We have, for the first quarter, participants can enroll at any quarter. And so what we currently have is data on the first quarter of 2010, and we are showing 753 doctors and 48 nurse practitioners for a total of 801 participants. The program is administered by the State Accident Insurance Fund, and the projection is that the total expenditure will be is $28.1 million through third quarter of 2009. SAFE projects a total expenditure of $3.8 million for calendar year 2009, and we do project that there will be sufficient funding through the remaining 2 years of the program to maintain the subsidies at that glide path level without further reductions. So the program does continue to provide rate relief for those needing medical malpractice insurance, and here is the good news. The rates have stabilized and, in fact, come down since this program was initiated. It's not cause and effect, but it is a cyclical type of market. We were in 2003 looking at a market that had very significant increases, and since that time we have had some decreases. I included attached or with the testimony a press release we put out last spring, which has a chart summarizing the rate decreases for our two largest insurers that cover most of the market. In 2007, they were down 10.2% and 3.2% respectively. 2008, we saw decreases of 8.9% and 7.6%. In 2009, one of them held rates flat, and the other one went down 2.5%. So that is good news for those who were certainly experiencing some rate shock. So the program is currently scheduled to sunset after calendar year 2011. And I'm happy to answer any questions, and I think Mr. Ekblad probably has more information about some of the participation in the program.
Have you been in discussion with the healthcare policy board or reform group and so on?
Well, we are in regular contact with the Oregon Health Authority
on
a range of the House Bill 2009 issues. And the Health Authority has put together a committee to look at medical liability, professional liability issues.
Have there been anything other than anecdotal information about physicians who may leave the practice in rural Oregon if this program stops?
I think I'm going to ask Scott if he's got an answer to that question.
Okay.
Because we don't deal directly with the physician population.
Okay. I know of one person in Pendleton who said they were going to go to Costa Rica if the program.
Well, Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health.
Thank you, Corey.
Our role in administering this program is to determine eligibility of the folks who participate, the physicians and nurse practitioners who participate. And since Corey does such a fantastic job of bringing you the statistical information, and I don't want to simply repeat what she has to say, she knows more anyway, I thought I'd bring the anecdotal evidence. So Friday afternoon, we sent out an email to all the recipients of the medical malpractice reinsurance subsidies and asked simply two questions. One, on a scale of 1 to 5, from not important to very important, how important is the malpractice premium subsidy in your decision to remain in practice in rural Oregon? And number two, Scott's going to Salem. What do you want him to say? And so the information that you have in front of you, and you know what? I sent it out Friday afternoon. We had to cut it off at 3 o'clock yesterday. This is 20 pages of responses. They were still coming in. And the single sheet that you have that is clearly a photocopied fax was one that came in just as I was leaving to come here today. And I said, this one's so great, you got to give me copies of this one. So, you know, I'm not going to sit here and repeat everything that was said, but basically I'll give you some highlights. I'm just going to read, I'd say randomly, except I did go through with a highlighter, so that isn't exactly random. We would have to close our clinic and move to a metro area. Malpractice subsidies are extremely important. On the south coast of Oregon, my insurance reimbursements are substantially lower than the metropolitan areas. Therefore, higher malpractice premiums take a higher proportion of my income. I will have to move away from this area and join a large group in one of those metropolitan areas. That's a Coos Bay physician. Pioneer Hospital in Prineville has closed the OB department. OB patients in the Prineville area must now travel to Bend or Redmond. The incentives have been helpful, but clearly not enough. Without them, I'm sure you can look for other rural hospitals to follow suit. Malpractice premium subsidy makes it financially possible for me to continue in practice on a reduced time schedule. Otherwise, I would just retire.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm reading this one from Treasure Valley Women's Clinic, and this person says, Dr. Robert Mayers, says that right across the border in Idaho, the malpractice insurance for their physicians is way below what this person has to pay. So why the discrepancy there with Idaho's malpractice insurance and Oregon?
You know, Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, I bet Corey can answer that better than I suspect that when they say right over the border in Idaho, they're probably also talking the difference between rural Oregon and urban Idaho, Boise.
Yeah.
Well, I went to an NCSL conference, and I had multiple copies of our plan to take back to the conference, and I was sitting next to Representative Maurer in that room that day when I talked about it. And I thought I would be deluged by all these people who would want a copy of our plan. The only one who asked for it was a guy sitting behind me who was from Kentucky and thought it was really cool. Well, Maurer said, which I didn't know, we are only one of 11 states that does not have some sort of a malpractice cap.
Yep.
And that's why Idaho probably does.
Yep.
And so so this is a substitute for that, but it's not the real thing. The real thing would be to have some caps, but I don't know if we're ever going to reach that part, but it is frustrating.
Good answer, Senator.
Well, and that's the way it was. I found that out. I didn't know that we were one of 11 states that didn't have it. And there was not that much interest in our plan. Only Kentucky, who didn't have it, thought it was a cool plan.
We don't have caps.
So we're subsidizing based on the malpractice insurance, which should be less. Now, it is coming down a little bit, but that's not enough.
And, Mr. Chair, as you may recall, as part of this program initially, there was actually a study commissioned to look at all of the variables and how they affect rates. Now it's done by the Pinnacle Group, and that study is probably on some of your shelves, and we can certainly provide a link to it if people want to refresh on its conclusions.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Before we continue, question for Scott. When you asked those two questions, did you say anything about the possibility of cutting the subsidy?
Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, yes, I reminded them that it's due to end in 2011. It's a finite pot of money. It's
okay.
Not funded by a stream.
So you premised the questions by, you know, reminder, this is due to be cut.
Correct. Senator Morissette, we have another expert, Dr. Steiner, has also very good information as to why the premiums might be lower in Idaho.
Senator Morissette and ladies and gentlemen, thank you for allowing me to add one piece of information. The other thing that Idaho has that Oregon doesn't is pretrial screening boards, which is to say that Idaho has implemented a system where any medical malpractice suit goes before a board that's a combination of physicians, attorneys, other relevant consumer members that's been well established, and that group looks at the suit carefully and determines whether there's merit for it to proceed before it goes any further. And pretty much every state that's implemented that has seen a substantial reduction in malpractice trials, and the dollar awards for malpractice settlements and in, therefore, malpractice premiums. So
now,
in addition to the cap, that's the other major difference between Oregon and Idaho.
My son-in-law is in the very large law firm in Ontario, Oregon, and practices in Idaho, and he told me about that. And I don't know if I actually drafted the bill to that effect, but I was told that the lawyers hate it because they have to lay all their cards on the table when they do the negotiation. And that's not a very good strategy for for them. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think that's a great idea. I think, okay, it's they have to come together, but it's not binding arbitration.
We'll form the panel here, I think. So, yeah, it's terrible to get the truth out at the front end of things. It's just.
Positions and are going to be very grateful for you to continue.
Well, no, I think that's great. And if they sit down and do the mediation, then they will arrive at some kind of an equitable settlement. But the Trialer Association doesn't like that. Are there any lawyers out there?
Oh, no, I see they're all medical practitioners.
Senator, since you're retired, we could call this the Bill Morissette Bill.
Yeah, you could do that.
Okay. No, I had a bill that would have put Medicare, Medicaid practitioners under the cap that OHSU has, knowing that it wouldn't go anywhere, but at least it raised the awareness that we need to do something about medical malpractice. Yeah, well, we'll bring that back then.
Senator Morissette, if there's one other piece of information I can lay out there, and this, you know, this has as much to do with any incentive program for healthcare providers, for primary care providers, for rural, for urban, what have you. I'd just like to remind the committee that in Oregon there is one primary care doctor for every 1,300 people in rural Oregon, and in urban Oregon there's a primary care physician for every 720 people. So there's essentially twice as many primary care physicians for the people in urban as is rural, and that's why we have incentive programs that are aimed specifically at rural Oregon.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I've been trying to do, I've talked to the governor's office several times, making rural health care economic development issue, and to use lottery funds and to make that part of his legacy. But without a windmill, he won't do it.
Or an electric car.
You're under our form, Senator.
Anyway, it is an economic development issue. Definitely it is. And I think if we expect companies to settle in rural Oregon, we need to have adequate education and adequate health care. Otherwise, they won't do it. And that those are the two limitations. And I'm very concerned that I think the population is still a shift away from rural, and it's very disturbing that we're going to have that wider gap now. So we need to do something.
Okay. Thank you.
It's interesting. So many of these responses are from Roseburg. Roseburg's taken very good advantage of this. You know, a lot of our new physicians, and we've got a few, wouldn't be there without this.
Right.
Oh, they're positive responses.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
I was afraid they were all going to leave. No. I mean, in his survey, a lot of the responses were from Roseburg
down there.
To stay.
Yeah. Everybody in the South. Roseburg really.
Okay. Update on. Okay, Kathleen Haley. You can kind of fill us in on the other part of this.
We're going to start at the end, aren't we?
Work session. That's where the excitement is.
Implementation of license by endorsement for physicians.
Sure.
What?
It was a bill in 2430, temporary license for rural docs.
Oh, temporary license for rural docs. Okay.
But they call it something else.
Okay, but we call it something else.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board. The Oregon Medical Board is comprised of 12 members and has responsibility for the licensing, investigation, and discipline of physicians, physician assistants, podiatrists, and acupuncturists in the state. And the mission of the board is to protect the health, safety, and well-being of Oregon citizens. In the 2009 session, House Bill 2435 was passed, and that implemented the expedited endorsement license for physicians. We started development on the administrative rules almost as soon as Sine Die happened, and we had the board develop and accept the temporary rules in October of this year. Then we began training our staff on the procedures for implementing it, and we began in December, but we also backdated it to those applications that had come in since November.
To date, 54 of the 75 applicants from out of state did qualify for the expedited endorsement license. And right now, we're working on the final rules with our stakeholders, primarily the Medical Association as well as the Hospital Association. A current draft of those rules is with the Attorney General's office, and then I would like to have it to the board this week because they're having a board meeting. So then we'd be able to move toward resolution on the final rules. As we continue to move forward with this process, I'd like to provide you with additional data on the outcomes. And I have attached a copy of the temporary rule for your review, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have this afternoon.
Where are these people coming from, and where do you...
Chair Morissette, from all over the country. They would be coming from all over the country.
Is there any tracking data on where they want to go?
Chair Morissette, not at this time. Most of the other states that are bringing us the physicians do come from California and Washington. Where they go, we will be tracking in the future. But we don't know where they'll be going.
Oh, I mean, where they want to go when they come to Oregon.
Chair Morissette, sometimes they tell us and sometimes they don't. Oh, but we have to wait and see, too, where they land. They may start with one place in mind and end up serving... getting a job in another part of the
now,
state.
Now, is there a greater in-migration than out-migration?
Chair Morissette, overall, yes.
There is?
Yes.
In-migration?
Yes.
Interesting.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On page 2, one of the criteria you listed was no significant malpractice claims as determined by the board. Who's going to define that? How shouldn't that be more significantly defined? I'm thinking of a fantastic pediatric cardiologist who's had two significant malpractice claims. He's working on hearts the size of a peanut. And yes, he's lost some lives, and yes, he's saved many, many lives. Pretty soon, he isn't going to probably be able to get malpractice insurance, and therefore no lives will be saved with his practice because he won't be able to practice. So can you tell us where you are on that piece?
Chair Morissette, yes, Senator Mona Sanderson, we are going to further refine that to look at patterns of care or significant patient care issues. But I'll have to tell you, in practice, what happens is that staff would bring an example of a malpractice like you're describing with your pediatric cardiologist to our medical director who's on staff. He would review it, and I think in 99.9% of the cases, that would not hold up a license application. But you could have, say, a regular pediatrician where you had 7 or 8 malpractice. That would be unusual. That would be something we might want to take a look at. So it's really on a case-by-case basis, but overall it does not hold up either eligibility for this or overall licensure.
So you don't think it will hold up? Okay.
It seems to me there was a glitch in examining the doctor that came here from a foreign country and was at OHSU and was found to have severe malpractice in other places and so on, and had some here. I don't remember the name of that person. It was an OHSU practitioner, wasn't it?
Kaiser. He was a Kaiser.
Kaiser.
And he came from Australia.
Are you familiar with that?
Chair Morissette, I think you're talking about Dr. Patel. He was disciplined by the Oregon Board, and then he went to Australia and did not report the discipline from the Oregon Medical Board. And then Australia just went ahead and licensed him without doing sufficient background checks, and then there were a number of deaths, and he was charged criminally.
Oh, it wasn't that he wasn't... He didn't do his malpractice in Oregon, though.
Chair Morissette, he had difficulties with large surgeries. He didn't have problems with what are considered smaller surgeries. The medical board restricted his ability to do those large surgeries. He then left the state and went to Australia and didn't report that restriction to Australia.
Is that something that should have been caught before he came in, before he was licensed?
It went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
He was okay when he came to the state of Oregon. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, Chair Morissette. His problems developed as he took on more risky patients
Larger
surgery.
Okay, that's okay. Good. Because
Okay. Good. Other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Now we are going to go into a work session. And I will open the work session, and we will have some invited testimony, perhaps, if...
If I can leave the room to go get Mr. Cosgrove.
Yeah, okay.
And then you can also start with the housing. Lisa and...
Are you here for the housing? Oh, okay, good, okay. Okay, we will open a work session on Legislative Concept 90... Six relating to contracts for housing developments. Okay, this is a work session with invited testimony, so go ahead.
Which one are we looking at?
96, which is a housing. Okay, go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
Thank you very much. Chair Marisette and members of the committee, I'm Marlis McNeil, Division Administrator for the Asset Property Management Division of Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Okay.
I'm here today to provide background about Legislative Concept 96 related to housing and community services' ability to contract. The purpose of the Asset Property Management Division is regulatory analysis, technical assistance, administration, and enforcement of restrictive covenants. Our thorough review of management practices and regulatory compliance ensures a quality of affordable housing communities for low to moderate income Oregonians. Our efforts also protect the public's investment in housing. Oregon Housing Community Services personnel perform the enforcement duties for department-funded affordable housing, as well as properties included in the project-based contract administration for U.S. Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. Housing and Community Services has administered the HUD Multifamily Section 8 contract for the last 9 years. HUD, concerned with using federal dollars as judiciously as possible, is revamping the current contract process. One option that HUD is exploring is a move to regional rather than state-based contracts for our Section 8 portfolio. Housing and Community and Services wants to ensure that this portfolio remains under our oversight and to maintain the current source of $1.3 million in annual revenue from HUD. To do these things, Oregon Housing needs the ability to submit a regional bid if it becomes necessary. ORS 456.625, subsection 12, is written, limits our ability to engage our services for properties only within Oregon. Because of this restriction, in 2005, our department was not able to contract with HUD to perform compliance duties on properties in the state of Idaho. The opportunity to contract with the state of Idaho had the potential to generate approximately $500,000 in additional revenue annually to our department. The requested change to ORS 456.625, subsection 12, would allow Oregon Housing and Community Services to contract out of state as well as perform enforcement duties for properties within Oregon that have not received development funds from our department. For instance, properties of local housing authorities within the state that may not employ compliance staff. The proposed legislation would benefit our state's affordable housing portfolio. The fees collected for our current contract with HUD provide for more than the direct cost of compliance services and supplements the development of more affordable housing in the state of Oregon. If the department had the opportunity to expand its contracting ability, there would be more revenue available for additional development within the state. Thank you for the opportunity to represent Oregon Housing and Community Services today. I'm very happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I was under the impression, and it may be correct or not correct, or partially correct, that the main gist of your request was to give you the authority to
bid or contract in a multi-state setting, which you can't do right now.
Senator
Warren. Now, that HUD is going regional for their disbursement of funds, and you want it to be able to...
Senator Morissette,
what has this got to do with your contract with the state of Idaho? I don't understand.
Well, at this current time, our, as I said in my testimony, for the last 9 years, 9 years ago, the federal Congress asked that states take over compliance monitoring for the federal government for HUD Section 8 projects. Mm-hmm. Section 8 projects, as many of you know, house the very lowest of the low-income Oregonians that we have, at 30% of area median income. The federal government hadn't done a very good job at making sure that that housing was safe, decent, sanitary housing for the residents. And the states, individual states, took over, most individual states took over the responsibility to make sure that those apartment communities were within regulatory guidelines, that the apartment communities were maintained to an appropriate level. We in the state of Oregon bid and on that contract, received it. It's been very, very beneficial to our agency. At a time when our agency is, as many of you know, we're self-funded. We have a very small amount of general fund. It is beginning to get more difficult for us to survive as an agency. And frankly, these dollars that have come into our agency have allowed us to continue to do the good work that we have within the state, and it has maintained the communities and the homes that the low-income Oregonians live in to a higher level. Now, through the Obama initiatives, they have decided that they're going to contract this. They're going to ask for a request for proposal again, and they may take away our right to just bid on our state alone. Unfortunately,
what has this got to do with Idaho, though?
Well, what it would... We were asked, for instance, about 5 years ago to take over monitoring responsibility for the state of Idaho by HUD because they were not doing a very good job.
Okay.
Because we've had a really good record with HUD, they asked us to take over that monitoring responsibility, and frankly, we couldn't do it because we didn't have the authority according to this ORA.
I see. Okay.
So this would allow us, if... The requirements, and the requirements for the new contract that are coming out are not yet, they've not been published. But we understand that there could be an opportunity that they will only be taking bids from states that will do more than one state. So if that's the case, we want to have the opportunity not only to keep the revenue that we already have coming into our agency, because quite frankly, it has helped our agency to be able to continue to function. And these funds more than pay for our direct costs. As a matter of fact, bring quite a bit of profit into our agency, which then we're allowed to continue the programs that we deliver to Oregonians. We're also able to build more affordable housing.
Well, now, wait a minute. You cannot do this in Idaho under the present.
That is correct.
And they have asked you at one... No, HUD asked you, not Idaho.
Right. That is correct. This is a HUD initiative, and it is a fee for... It's fee for performance contract, and it's been very, very beneficial for us as an agency. We want to continue to provide that level of service to our residents that we've served all these years.
Well, I can understand that part, but I still don't understand why Idaho don't, why they don't have their act together and can't do their own monitoring.
Question. Can you give us some context of when you say compliance monitoring, what do you mean? Is it on-site? Is it how many staff are involved? Give us a bigger picture. And then in the HUD's RFP, do you anticipate what other adjoining states
happy to, Senator Morissette, Senator Winters. We currently do this complex monitoring with a staff of 14 members. We do go on site to all 272 apartment communities located throughout the state on an annual basis, and more often if we need to, but typically being there once a year is sufficient. There are general inspectors that go out from the federal government. We don't have to do the inspections of each unit any longer like we had to in the past. However, we will follow up on those inspections, and those inspections are done by the federal government. It's called the REAC inspection, and those are done depending on what kind of a score the apartment community will get, either on an annual basis or sometimes every 2 to 3 years. We follow up on those inspections to make sure that the property managers on site, if they said that they were going to do something, did in fact complete those duties. And then the rest of the time we spend looking at the apartment community as a whole, looking at the common area, reviewing management practices, and then reviewing files for the residents to make sure that the right resident is living in the correct unit, paying the correct rent.
Follow-up.
Yes.
Since there would be, if you went into Idaho or some other states, you're talking about, and if your staffing was from Oregon, you're talking about travel and some of those others.
Yes.
Is there the feasibility, a possibility to outsource that through private contracting rather than setting up a larger state bureaucracy?
Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, this is a very, very good question. And I will be frank with you and tell you that at this point, we don't have the requirements of the bid yet, and we certainly have considered that. I don't know if it's going to be possible. Once we get the requirements of the request for proposal, that may be something we will be looking at. Currently, there are some other entities in the United States that are not agencies such as ours. They're quasi-government or private organizations that do monitoring for several states. We've been very successful at it in Oregon. We believe we can take that model and promulgate that into other states. Certainly will be something that we'll be looking at. Frankly, we can't even get there from here unless we're able to have this opportunity to be able to do this. But it's all of those things will be things that we'll be looking at in the future.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Follow up. I do understand that there is this function of compliance that's done for banks and other entities that is done in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
Across this country on a very routine, normal basis, and that's the reason I raise the issue of whether or not this could not be outsourced or negotiated with a private entity rather than bringing on a whole new system. And your RFPs will determine that.
Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, you're exactly right. I have actually held my position with the agency for 12 years now, and I have looked in the past through almost every biennium for the state of Oregon looking at doing just that. Would it be less expensive for us to? We have a responsibility because of the state dollars that have funded many of these projects to assure that they are maintained sufficiently, that regulatory compliance is maintained, that the right residents are living there, people of the correct income. And I've looked at almost every 2 years, is it more beneficial for us to contract it out with a private contractor or do it with our employees? And without fail, I have found that it is still beneficial cost-wise for us to do it in-house. And we've done this so long now that we have really gotten we have a plan together. It's been very successful. Our fee currently is based on a base fee, and then there's an incentive fee that we can earn. If we do things timely, if we do certain tasks in a certain manner, and we've been very successful in even being able to get that incentive, I would say over 95% of the time. I don't believe that this is a, for some of you, like Senator Berger, you may remember me in past years talking about this program. I think that all of these things will be things that we will consider when we get more information from the federal government, and we expect that their requirements should be coming out within the next 30 days or so.
Senator Berger.
Is there any downside from this bill to any Oregon business?
Right.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, Senator Berger, not that I can think of. I can't think of any. I can think that it would enhance business in some ways, because the more money that we're able to make, and as we go into these very difficult economic times, it's absolutely vital as agencies, I believe, for us to think about ways we can support ourselves and support our programs without having to come to this body to ask for more money. And this will only help us continue to do that. We will be able to build more developments. We will then be able to employ more contractors. We will be able to have better housing and more housing for the Oregonians that are here. I can't think of a downside for Oregon business.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Are there businesses that do home inspections in Oregon?
Senator Morissette, Senator Winter, yes, there are. And as a matter of fact, those are some of those people that I've talked with about prices of when I do the analysis as I'm looking at how are we going to manage this program in years to come. Those are some of the people that I've actually checked with relative to prices and that type of thing on some of these issues.
Could you provide us with the cost of home inspections on average?
Sure.
And in comparison to what it cost us having the agency do it and what's out there in the private sector?
Be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? We are in work session and we need a motion.
No, I can't. I'm no longer on this committee. I'm here illegally.
Oh. Mr. Chair, I move that we introduce LC 96. Pardon?
I've got it written out.
Oh, you got it written out. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Chair Morissette, I move that LC 96 dated 12/10/09 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Berger moves at 96, that Senate concept, LC 96.
Six.
Dated
12/10/09
be sent to
be introduced
as a committee bill.
Thank you.
Okay. Discussion. Further discussion. Okay. Seeing.
My own discussion. I'll vote for the bill to move it along, but I would like to have the issues.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about two different issues.
Yeah.
We're talking about the implementation of this, and then the second issue is whether or not it's cost effective, which should be a different discussion later.
Be
on.
Happy to provide that to the committee.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, although I'm no longer on this committee, I'd agree with Senator Winters. The ability, giving the agency the ability to go beyond borders, if that's where HUD comes down, I think is appropriate, but there may be other questions also that
okay.
can be answered.
Okay, seeing no objections, we will call for, there are no objections, would you call the roll, please?
Yeah, just for February.
Senator
Mondes
Anderson?
Yes.
Yes.
Senator Winters?
Yes.
Vice Chair Tucker?
She says yes.
Yeah. Present.
Thank you very much.
We're doing with 96.
Okay.
Yeah.
Aye.
Okay. So.
Now they leave, and what happens?
The bill passes, and we will send it to LC.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, so we are now going to open a work session on LC 86, and we will allow some limited rational testimony. And if you meet that criteria, you may continue to.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Kasker, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. I'll be limited and as rational as possible.
Okay.
This bill is coming to you as a work in progress. Last session, through Senator Mona Sanderson's Health Committee, and some of you served on that committee, there was a dental hygiene bill that came without any opposition from the House and was approved in the Senate without opposition. It was with the understanding that there were two issues that were going to be set aside for further discussion amongst the various interested parties and potentially brought back to the February session. And this bill addresses those two issues, but the discussions are still ongoing and are not yet complete. I'm hopeful that at least one of the two issues, and I'll describe what they are, we will have reached a resolution by the time of the February session, which means this concept would have to be amended to deal with only the one issue than which there's agreement and the other one set aside for later. The issues have to do with what a limited access permit dental hygienist can do without supervision by a dentist. And limited access permit dental hygienists only do what dental hygienists do, but they do it independently without supervision. And since the statute was originally passed about 8 or 10 years ago, there were exceptions that have required a limited access permit dental hygienist, even though they're acting independently, to have some level of supervision by a dentist to do certain functions. We've eliminated most of those. There are two that are addressed by this bill. I'd like to just, for the background of the committee, supervision in the Dental Act is very different than what you might think of as supervision. There are three levels of supervision of a dental hygienist. One is direct supervision. The dentist is in the room watching. One is indirect supervision. The dentist is in the building and available. And the other is general supervision. The dentist is somewhere and once looked at the chart. To give you an example, in one of the negotiation sessions we were having at Oregon Dental Association, we were talking about one of these functions, which is local anesthesia, which is given by dental hygienists because when they're doing root planing for people who are of, shall we say, slightly more than middle age like me and may have not had perfect dental care or not done all the flossing I was supposed to do, and you have to have a deeper kind of cleaning, it sometimes is painful and there's a little numbing done of the gums. That's the kind of ways that dental hygienists use local anesthesia. And this dentist was sitting at the table in Wilsonville, and he was asked, well, are your hygienists back in Salem doing this for their patients? He said, I hope so, right now, if a patient needs it. So that is general supervision. It means that the dentist has a patient of record and has seen the chart at some time, but doesn't have to be anywhere nearby. The current requirement for an LAP is to have general supervision for local anesthesia, and the problem with that is it means that the dental hygienist has to hire a dentist to review the record, and the dentist takes some liability for it, and it's difficult in areas of rural areas. So we have proposed to eliminate the general supervision requirement for local anesthesia, and I think we are close. We'll find out in February and be able to report to you reaching agreement on that issue. The second one is to do with temporary restorations, and just to tell you what that is, when there's obvious decay, it's a procedure that's used in the military, it's used by dental therapists in other countries, it's used in Alaska, it's used in Minnesota. The hygienist is allowed to brush away, not with a drill or anything, brush away the obvious decay and deposit a little bit of polymer that has fluoride in it as a temporary way to stop further decay until permanent restoration can be made. That's the second issue in which currently dental hygienists have to have general supervision if they have a limited access permit to do, but otherwise can do. So those are the issues that we're discussing with all the advocates. The advocates include the Board of Dentistry, the Oregon Dental Association, Willamette Dental Group, Capital Dental Group, all the interested parties, public health as well. And I hope we'll be able to come to you with a resolution, which will then need, I'm sure, some amendments in LC 86, okay. But then I hope we'll be able to be passed by this body.
Okay. Now, you've described the Mona Sanderson due diligence process.
Mr. Chairman, we took the whole bill through that process last time, and this is a continuation, effectively, of that process.
But
where we're
because
still
she asked that this be introduced as a committee bill, I assume that she has made sure that you've jumped through all of the hoops.
Well, we will need, as part of the testimony, have, you know, explanation of their education, and just what the psychologists right. have done with their bill and the
naturopath. You can make it through her process. I'm all for it.
Well, and just to clarify, when the bill 3204 with these provisions came through, we had the whole written report was done last session, and and when we came to you and passed that bill, we said we're going to continue to work on these two issues. So it's really a continuation of the process that we started.
Okay. Senator Cruz, are you on this committee?
You're a guest.
I'm a guest.
Oh, well, go ahead.
Thank you for accommodating me, Senator. You know, this is a nice committee. I ought to try it sometime. You say brush away decay. Well, obviously, it's not with a brush. They file or something, right? How do they brush away decay?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, as you know, I'm not licensed as a health care
provider.
But as I have been, I understand the process to be as they use a hand tool. And it
more like a pick or something like that?
It is sometimes, for shorthand, called scoop and fill. You take a small scoop and you remove the obvious decayed material just to attach the polymer, which, by releasing fluoride, stops further decay till the permanent restoration can be done.
Mr. Chair, my dentist, in fact, I was supposed to have my teeth cleaned this coming Thursday, but I now have another obligation, which is a blessing. But, my dentist, she operates totally independently. She doesn't, he comes in, she does all the x-rays, he comes in and looks at the x-rays to see if there's anything more detailed that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, there's really no contact there. So hopefully they can work this thing out, because this is another access to care issue.
Yeah.
So.
My dentist is a very hands-on dentist.
I would be very hesitant to support the local anesthetic part of their bill, unless the dentist was actually in the building or in close proximity. I have an absolute serious anaphylactic allergy to local anesthetics. I would die in a dentist chair if they gave me 4 or 5 local anesthetics. And fortunately, I go to the allergist and I'm tested before I have injections. And I tell people that, and if I'm in the hospital, I've got every kind of bracelet on possible. But that is a huge responsibility when a dental hygienist would say, oh, well, we need to numb your gums. It isn't that. It's the fact that for 20 years I had dental work done with nothing, because there was not one anesthetic that I could take. Now I have one, and only one, that I'm not severely, death wish allergic to. So I cannot imagine having this kind of lack of supervision, such as he's available, you can call him on the phone. They've got to know how to do a lot of injections and a lot of medical procedure to save your life. So would you like to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, your concern is well-founded in the sense that it can be a very serious problem. However, dental hygienists, whether they had limited access permit or not, have been doing local anesthesia with a special endorsement and special training in the state of Oregon for at least 15, if not 20 years. And I remember when the issue came up about this change for just the LAP hygienists, do they still need general supervision? And recall, general supervision means they're not even in the same town, potentially. They're wherever. They've seen the chart. There has been one incident complaint in the board in the entire time that this has been done by dental hygienists. It's done very frequently by dental hygienists. I'd be happy to bring to you the woman who is the chair of the current Board of Dentistry. She is a dental hygienist, but she works at OHSU. She actually teaches dentists how to do local anesthesia, and she can describe for you the detailed training that dental hygienists and dentists have about local anesthesia, and that it's in fact comparable. She would suggest in some cases the hygienists get more detailed training in anesthesia, and they're all required to have emergency response capability and all of those things. It's actually pretty detailed, but it has been happening already in this state without this change. In every dentist's office I'm aware of, I go to periodontist because I wasn't as good at flossing as I should have been, and the periodontist is rarely in the building when I'm there, and I sometimes get local anesthesia, and it's always done by a dental hygienist. So it's current practice, and I think there's been a long history of it not being a problem. But you are correct. If there is a problem, it's serious.
But in her case, I mean, the hygienist still got access to the charts.
Yes.
And her chart will show that.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Monasen.
Yes, I have a question. This is only for limited access dental hygienist, correct?
This change is only for limited access dental hygienist.
And I think you need to clarify there's a difference between just any dental hygienist and one who has had extensive training as a limited access dental hygienist.
And I'd be happy if I haven't made that clear. But the one thing I do want to say is any hygienist with their current training and certification is currently able to provide local anesthesia without a dentist on the premises. What this provides is limited access permit. Dental hygienists would be able to do so even though there isn't a dentist of record for the patient, that the dentist hasn't reviewed the record, which they are now doing for all their other hygiene services. So right now, the thing that you're concerned about, Senator, is happening in Oregon, but it's happening with both kinds of dental hygienists. LAP hygienists have additional training, and that's why we think the change is appropriate.
I don't know. I have a regular dental hygienist whom I love, and I don't take any anesthetic. And all of my family use the dental hygienist on a very regular basis. So I don't know if any of them get any kind of injections. I would doubt it. I would doubt it. But I just want to, I guess if they have special training and they know how to bring you out of an anaphylactic, then that's okay. But
Mr. Chairman, Senator Virgil, they have to have a special any hygienist has to have a special certification to do local anesthesia, which means they've gone through a special board exam, clinical exam, and had additional training. I maybe should have made that clear at the beginning. But not every hygienist can do this, but every hygienist who's done this has had the same kind of training that a dentist has in local anesthesia.
One follow-up,
yes.
Mr. Chair. I want to say that the people like me are in the smaller percentage. And so the majority of people that would go into the dentist's office or the hygienist's office would not have that problem. But if it's your problem, it's 100%.
So.
My sister is the same way. Even just a little dab on the gum, and her heart just starts racing. Mm. So I think they're more of you than
And it is one that I, been part of this discussion, I've heard this special efforts that all healthcare providers, hygienists, dentists, and I'm sure other healthcare providers who use local anesthesia now do in order to address that issue because it is a serious reaction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your plan is then, and if we choose to pass this bill, to adopt this bill as a committee bill, you will come back with more clarification.
If there's agreement, it moves. Yes. If there's not agreement, it doesn't.
Yeah, okay. So let's have a motion and see if it moves.
Okay, so are you in work session?
Yes, we're in work. Yeah, we are in work session.
Move the bill?
Yeah.
Okay. Chair Morissette, I move that LC 86, dated 12-9-09, be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Virgil moves that LC 86, dated January 12th, 10, be introduced as a committee bill. Further discussion? Disagreement? If there's no further discussion, no objection, then we will... I prefer to do the roll call.
Senator Ron Sanders?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Vice Chair Telfer?
Aye.
And Chair Morrison?
Aye. Okay.
Thank you.
So moved. Any other business for the order? Seeing none, we are adjourned.
So did I really-